Hi everyone, and welcome to the sixth episode in the Giant Linear Song of Ice and Fire reread of Destiny. Today we're covering the first half of September 298. My name's Bina 007, and I am joined by Matt.
Hey, what's up everyone? It's Matt Varley on the forums.
Also by Nadia.
Or not.
Hello everyone, this is Nadia.
And by first-time podcaster, Scott.
Hello, I'm Shaggy Dog on the forums.
So Scott, because you have to do the tedious stuff, so how did you get into Song of Ice and Fire? Is this your first reread and all that kind of stuff? Who's your favorite character as well, I guess we should ask?
My favorite character is Arya. I just like her overall story arc and the whole sort of Count of Monte Cristo aspect to it. Meets sort of like Little Orphan Annie is kind of a neat
line. Meets Psycho.
Well, yeah, that too. I got into the story, my brother recommended it, and he kind of said it just wasn't, you know, the typical hero's journey that you kind of get with, like, Lord of the Rings and, you know, a lot of the other fantasy novels that are out. So I gave it a shot, and I started reading the Jon chapters. I'm like, this is so the typical journey. And then I really got hooked when they executed Ned, actually, because I didn't see that one coming. So, yeah.
Don't think anyone did, really. And is this your first... Are you one of these people who's read it loads and loads of times, or...?
I've read it twice. And so this is like my actual linear reread for the first time. I didn't even realize, actually, when I first read it that they were out of sequence until it got to Feast of Crows and Dance of Dragons.
Yeah, I don't think many people do. I think it's just with the Dany chapters, that was the big shock of realizing just how out of sequence she is. It's weird doing it this time for me, just realizing how much George does mix things up. I wonder how conscious that is, though.
Well, that's F.T. Ward's argument, right? That George put them in a specific order for a reason.
Yeah, I think F.T. Ward has a definite respect for George's mapping that I maybe don't have as much of. Like, he's not Tolkien, right? He's not concerned as much, I think, with the meticulous mapping of everything.
No.
But I could be being unfair.
No, I think that's pretty fair. I think he does a lot of that just to sort of, you know, guide the reader and put them into, you know, certain directions to give him a kind of idea as to either where the story's going to go, and then that helps him to throw a twist into it at some point.
Yeah, I think you're right. So, given that F.T. Ward doesn't think this is an official reread, nonetheless, we plow on. So, today we're doing Ned 5, Jon 4, Cat 5, Tyrion 4, and Ned 6, which is basically going to take us through the capture of Tyrion by Cat and Sam turning up at the wall. So, don't be too enthusiastic, Wally. The first chapter is Ned 5, and I think Scott has prepared notes.
I have. So Ned 5 starts off with Ned discussing the death of Jon Arryn with Grandmaster Pycelle. Ned's been under the impression that the prior Hand of the King was poisoned, thanks to the note that was sent to him from his sister-in-law, Lysa. Pycelle tells Ned that the signs were there that something was wrong with him, but he initially just dismissed it as some of the worries that are associated with running the realm and Jon Arryn's sort of crazy wife and his problematic child. But then, just a few minutes later, when Ned asks him about the final illness, Pycelle says that Jon Arryn came to him looking for a book, and he looked hale and healthy as ever, and then the next day he was doubled over in pain to get out of bed. We also learn that originally Pycelle wasn't providing care, that Coleman was providing care, who's also a maester, and he was attempting to purge him with wasting tonics and pepper juice. And I actually, not having any medical background at all, I googled sicknesses plus purging, and I got a whole lot of things about bulimia, and I couldn't find an actual illness that you use purging to get rid of illness.
It sounds like that weird diet that, like, celebrities like Beyonce do, where they have this sort of lemon juice and
the
cayenne
pepper.
Yeah, exactly. Farley, you sound like you have first-hand knowledge of this diet.
Yeah, so I used to work in a coffee shop with a hippie vegan that went through a cleanse, and she was miserable. Absolutely miserable.
Was that because she was going through a cleanse, or because she was vegan?
Yes.
All of the above.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. Some people just react differently, but yeah, apparently it's pretty gross, though. After like a week or so, you really start cleansing and gross stuff comes out of you.
At which point it might be useful to have a bidet.
True. Or just a Toto toilet.
Just saying. Indeed. Sorry, Scott, back to the chapter.
Sorry. Yeah, so he then goes on to state that he dismissed Coleman and took over care as he was concerned his approach wasn't going to be able to work, as he was concerned that that John Aaron would pass away from the intensity of the treatments. And so then he took over, and unfortunately he wasn't able to save him, but when it became clear he wasn't going to be able to do it, he started giving him milk of the poppy to ease his passing. We learn also that in his final hours, John Aaron called for Robert. It's not exactly clear if it was his son or if it was the king he was asking for, but his final words were, "The seed is strong." Ned goes on to ask him if he's absolutely certain if he died of the sickness, and Picel said he is. When Ned suggested it's poison, Picel's kind of quick to throw Varys under the bus, pointing out that poison is often used by women, cravens, and eunuchs, and also asking Ned that if he knew that Varys was born as a slave in Lys, where poison is apparently pretty commoning. At the end, Ned thanks... Oh, did you have something, Bina?
He's not subtle, is he? That's all.
No, not at all. It's kind of like if your coworker comes back from lunch and his boss is standing there, and you're like, "Oh, I didn't know we had lunches that were 2.5 hours long. That's good to know."
What?
Yeah, I had a coworker who would do shit like that. Like, if somebody came back from lunch and they were like 20 minutes late, they would, you know, throw them under the bus and say stuff like, "Oh, gee, I didn't know our lunches were, you know, 2.5 hours long. That's good to know."
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Fucking office politics. Mm. All right, go on.
Okay. And before Ned leaves, he asks Picel to borrow the book that John Aaron wanted. Picel says he'll get it and send it to him once he finds it. And on the way back to his chambers, he bumps into Arya, who is standing atop a bunch of steps, practicing her balancing exercises, because she wants to become a water dancer. And she asks about Bran and if he's going to join them in King's Landing, and what his future career options are. Ned then begins to list off a whole slew of career options for Bran, becoming a great lord of a Holdfast, advisor to the king, an architect like Bran the Builder, maybe the High Septon, or he could even live a life of adventure sailing across the Sunset Sea. And then Arya asks about her career options, and basically Ned tells her she can be a housewife and a stay-at-home mom to some lord or king. Arya is none too impressed with her career options from, you know, 1935, so she goes back to practicing and tells her dad that maybe Sansa might appreciate those options a little more. At the end of the chapter, Ned's in his chamber, and he gets a visit from Littlefinger, who gives him some useful leads to follow up on. Apparently there's a pregnant kitchen girl who wed one of Renly's men, a stable hand who joined the City Watch, and a potboy who was fired for stealing, and the recently promoted Sir Hugh of the Vale, who was John Arryn's former squire. This is kind of a fortunate stroke of luck, since Ned thought everyone in service to House Aaron had returned to the Vale. He decides he's going to go send for them immediately, and this prompts Littlefinger to point out some of the spies who are in the employ of the Queen and Varys that are keeping watch in the tower and tabs on who comes and goes. Littlefinger then asks if Ned has someone he trusts completely, and Ned tells him yes. Littlefinger replies and says the smarter answer was no, but he suggests he sends that person, as the Queen and Varys can't watch all of the Stark men all of the time. The chapter ends with Ned telling Littlefinger that he may have been mistaken for not trusting him when he arrived, and then Littlefinger kind of jokingly retorts to him with the line, "Distrusting me was the wisest thing you've done since you climbed down off your horse."
So why didn't John Aaron just say, "Hey, like, the children are bastards, like, why didn't he just give it all up?"
Yeah, good point.
I mean,
Well, he would have had to find a moment when Robert was sober enough or not busy.
But also, Robert really go drunk to his best friend's sort of dying sickbed, as much of a douchebag as he is?
Well, also, I mean, he was probably tipsy, maybe a little too much port, but
I'm not yet at the stage of too much port.
Okay.
I'll let you know. I'll give you a signal.
Is there such a stage?
Oh, there's definitely a stage. It's too much port.
But, I mean, seriously, like, the seed is strong, really? That's the best you can muster?
Well, he was being given, milk of the poppy and whatnot, so Maybe it was at that point.
I've rambled on for hours while stoned. I think you could probably get, something more than the seed is strong.
I mean, it depends whether you think, because it says at one point in the chapter that they were chatting, and then it talks about getting milk of the poppy at the end when he thought he wasn't going to make it, or when Maester Pycelle thought he wasn't going to make it. So I kind of interpreted it as that Robert and John had had a proper coherent chat, and that if John had chosen not to give it up to Robert, that, and assuming John's a clever man and that he's cogent, that this implies that he just didn't think Robert would back him or believe him. And given that we've just seen Ned go to Robert and say, look, Cersei's son has totally lied about what my daughter's wolf did, and Robert didn't back him over that, maybe he's right to suspect.
Yeah, but he could have been like, the reason Stan is just pieced out to Dragonstone is because he knows the truth as well. And he knows, shit's going to go down when this comes out. I just don't understand.
Maybe they didn't have enough solid proof. Maybe they were still trying to build the case against it, and he just kind of figured, I'll point him in the right direction, and maybe he'll figure it out on his own. Pycelle was, right there as well, so.
But, this is CSI King's Landing. There's not going to be DNA proof. I mean, the fact that he's got, black hair is, Gendry's got black hair and stuff. They could have laid all that out. I think it would have been pretty convincing, so. I don't know. It's a weird one.
Also, what do we think about Sir Hugh of the Vale?
Douchebag.
I mean, obviously, he's in John. So, what did he do? What was his role?
He's been bought off, right? He's been given the armor. So maybe he just stumbled upon something rather than having an active role.
Well, it seems like everybody on the small council, possibly with the exception of Barristan, kind of has a notion that, the Baratheon children are all bastards. I mean, Stannis fled to Dragonstone. Renly is walking around without Lockett, trying to figure out if he can, talk Robert into meeting the Tyrell girl.
But is that really because he fears that the kids are bastards, or more just because he doesn't like the Lannister influence?
I would think it was more Lannister influence, though. But, I don't know.
So, at this point, in later chapters, we discover that Pycelle thought Cersei had actually poisoned Jon, but still sent Colman away because he wanted the poison to take effect.
Mm.
What's Pycelle's motivation in all this? Why does he want Robert dead?
Well, he's a Lannister toady, but weren't the Lannisters at, wasn't she visiting Casterly Rock or something during this time?
Yeah, he tells Ned that Cersei was on the road to visit the tournament for Joffrey's name day. So she kind of gets an alibi.
But was she, though? I mean, has that been verified by a second person? So is Pycelle's motivation basically because he suspects Renly wants to get rid of Cersei, and because he's a Lannister toady, he wants Cersei to still be queen, so he needs to kill Robert, or to enable the killing of Robert?
I think he's just trying not to get in the way of her plan. If he really did think she's the one that poisoned Robert, he's allowing her to cover up the rumors of incest and stop him from looking into the potential truth of it. Robert did go to him the day before looking for that particular book that had the lineages and descriptions of the members of the houses.
Oh wait, was it Robert who went for that book or John?
I'm sorry, it was John Arryn.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, that sounds a bit too, bright for the concept of Robert ever going out in search of a book, I think is, has Robert ever even read a book?
Maybe one with pictures?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe if the fire goes out, he's like, oh, look, there's a book. I can use that.
Indeed. But also, why didn't Maester Coleman write a raven to someone and say, look, I've just been sent away from KL, but, weird shit's going down. We never hear of him again, do we? He just sort of disappears, so.
Don't we?
Do we not? I don't know.
I don't think we do.
My memory's
Wasn't Coleman the Maester in the Vale?
Oh, is he?
I might be wrong, but
Google this shit. And this is why I'm doing the reread, because I cannot remember this stuff. Maester Coleman. Talk amongst yourselves.
Even if he did send a raven from the Vale, Pycelle's going to be the one who gets it in King's Landing.
Right.
So
and he will read it, and if it, like, what does Vary say to Ned in the dungeons? Is like, if it serves my purpose, I'll let them know. If it doesn't, I'll just throw it out.
Mm. Okay, Maester Corman's all over the shop. He's the guy who's leeching Robert Arryn, and then he's doing all sorts of stuff. He's in attendance to him really and confess the murder of Lady Lyssa Arryn. So yeah.
Mm. Woohoo! I remember shit.
Mazel. Anything else in this chapter?
No, that's about it, except for it does kind of demonstrate at the end how Littlefinger kind of builds up social capital with people. He sort of provides them a little bit of help and or assistance indirectly towards a goal that they're interested in finding to kind of gain their trust so he can set them up for, you know, betrayal or deception or to get some kind of reward out of them down the road.
Yeah. It's just weird to me that, like, in retrospect, like, reading this, it's kind of hard to remember reading it for the first time, but this was what this book was all about. It was about the detective work. Like, I read it almost like an Agatha Christie novel. You know, like, who killed John Arryn and who's John's mum or whatever. And in retrospect, it doesn't really matter. It's just, yeah, I don't know. It feels so minimal in retrospect. Maybe that's just me.
Well, yeah, and then looking back, it's like, oh, not trusting me is the smartest thing you've ever done. It's like, oh, we find out in later chapters that, no, that's true.
Mm. Yeah, but Littlefinger plays it off really well. Just, it kind of, the first reread, you know, time you read through it, it comes off as, you know, he's, you know, having a joke with the guy. Oh, not trusting me is the first best thing you ever did. Haha. And then down the road, oh, wait, it really was the best thing you ever did.
Right, right. And, yeah, and it plays up just to more of the political intrigue that's going on, like, in King's Landing. Like, when he's pointing out, like, everyone's spies, like, oh, no, those are mine.
Mm.
Yeah, it's almost brazen, isn't it? It's really, it's clever. Anywho, on to John 4.
All right.
The White Raven honorary chapter.
Dedicated to Mimi, who is White Raven's wife's grandmother?
Yes.
Anyway, so broad strokes, Sam Tarly comes to the wall. They find out he's Craven. Like, John sticks up for him after he hears, like, the horror story that was his life. And all the guys get behind and don't beat up on him anymore. More specifically, we learn about members of the Night's Watch. There's a quarryman's son. Rast is a raper. Darian is also a raper, but he said that the girl, some lord's daughter, helped him through the window, and then she called it rape. We learned that Pip is a mummer and can do all sorts of stories and voices, and all his eunuch voices somehow sound like Alistair Thorne, which is weird. We learned that John is a prophet, because he goes down and he sees Rob and Ned and everyone in the crypts, and they have all died. Everyone except Arya so far. So that's a big prophetic, Arya is going to die.
You really are taking this, like, taking on White Raven's role very seriously.
this is real shit. Come on.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is real prophecy. That's true.
Yeah, and then, I mean, we can get into... I mean, that's basically the chapter. We can get into Sam's backstory and what you all think about that.
Well, apart from it just being horrifically horrific.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was awful. His father does a, like, tells him how it's going to be, like, very similar to season one in the show when Tywin's skinning the deer in front of Jaime. And he's just like, oh, well, you'll take the Night's Watch, or, you know, tomorrow we'll go hunting and you'll have an accident.
Hmm. Which makes me think, like, how horrific is that? Like, or are we just being all modern and namby-pamby? Like, is that just how parenting was in those days?
I suppose if you're Randall Tarly, you know, who fought against Robert, and I think they defeated one of Robert's armies, that is kind of a big thing. And that's what I thought the whole skinning the deer scene was about, was kind of like a reference back to that. And that seeing, you know, the kid that's supposed to be taking your place and supposed to be sort of the next in line is absolutely nothing like you or even in your eyes, remotely prepared, it is kind of a dickish thing to do, but I suppose back in the day, it probably would have been okay.
Yeah, I don't know, because, like, back in the day, they used to, like, you know, they wanted as many heirs as possible. So just to write off the eldest one seems a little weird, but, I mean, not that it didn't happen, but...
But it's rational, but, though. I mean, you want more, as many heirs as possible, because you need to defend or to see your family continue and prosper. So you're protecting against disease and death in other ways. And if the firstborn son is basically, in your view, not going to be capable of defending the honor of your house, then, you know, if Tyrion had been the eldest son, for instance, the same thing would have happened. I mean, it's all very well for Tywin to be all, but you're still a Lannister, even though you're a dwarf. But would he have that attitude if he was the eldest?
But it doesn't matter, because Jaime can't inherit anything anyway.
Yeah, so hence I always find it really bizarre that Tywin doesn't remarry.
Mm.
You know, the hypocrisy, like if family honor comes first.
Yeah. And it's also not like Randall didn't try with Sam. You know, he, in the book, says he went through like several attempts to try and, you know, cure him of being cowardly. It just, none of them worked. So he kind of did all he can, and he's like, well, I guess this is how it's going to be.
I bathed your fat ass in blood, and you still haven't got any balls? I don't know what else I can do.
And you just see, like, how, what a prick, Randall Tarly is. He gets, like, the guys from Quarth, the warlocks, and after, like, they bathe them in bull's blood and it doesn't fix them, like, he scourges them. Like, you get it, like, later on when I think he puts a lye and, like, orders, like, some whore to, like, have lye put into her vagina to, like, cleanse her.
What? Did I miss
when she's
that?
Doing in, I think it's in Feast for Crows.
Okay.
When Brienne gets the maiden pool,
mm-hmm.
and he's doing judgments, and, like, yeah, one woman is like gave the pox to like one of his soldiers or something, so he orders like her privates to be washed out with lye.
Jesus.
Which
Christ.
Has to be just
I'm crossing my legs.
Yeah, miracles of modern medicine, right?
That's the chapter where he does the famous "a woman's war is the birthing bed," right? That's very
right. Right. And if you get raped, like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, you brought it on yourself. He's not a nice person.
No.
Yeah.
But he is the only guy to defeat Robert in battle, so, you know.
Right. I mean, he's an extremely competent, like, battle commander, but he's, like, I think they gave, like, Tyrell, like, you know, what the fuck word am I looking for? Like, they gave Tyrell the win in that, even though it was Randall Tarly's van that beat him.
Oh, Tyrell took all the credit for it, even though
right.
Tarly did all the dirty work.
Exactly.
I also want to say that Heartsbane is an awesome name for a sword.
Mm. It is, and 500 years old.
And which is amazing, right? Because they're a minor house to the Tyrells, and yet they seem to have more sort of heritage, so to say. Is that one of the old? That's one of the older blades that's still around, I think. But I could be wrong.
I feel like Ice was also like 500 years old. So I don't know if there's like a, you know, tag sale on like Valyrian steel like 500 years ago. So, but
there's got to be someone out there, probably Kay Centurion, who's done a list of all the Valyrian steel swords we know to exist in their age.
I want to say that probably. Ice was a replacement sword for like an older blade that was also called Ice, but I could be wrong on that.
No, you're right, and it's very interesting on what that older blade was. I've always thought about that.
Hmm.
What's your theory?
That Ice might have been like the other sword Ice. You know, like
say what
you
now?
You mean like one of the blades that the others beyond the wall wield?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like I think it's Catelyn that says like the sword was Valyrian steel, it had the name Ice, but the sword named Ice was like older still or something like that.
Hmm.
It's like Catelyn 1 chapter.
So who currently has Ice? So it became Widow's Will, right? So that's with Tommen, and then...
Oathkeeper with Brienne.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, it would be cool if they had some ancient sort of magics from beyond the wall that got activated. That would make me happy.
Oh, all those magics.
Yeah.
So while they're hazing, like they immediately call him like Sir Piggy and Lord of Ham. While they're hazing him, he gets like the broad part of a sword like whacked on him so hard that it splits his leather. That's got to be fucking painful.
Yeah, you know, that always reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Full Metal Jacket.
Yep.
But it definitely reminded me of, you know, the recruit scenes and the basic training camps that they had to go through. And that one recruit that just kept doing everything wrong. I really thought the first time I read through this that, okay, this is going to be the one guy that does everything wrong. And then down the road, he's either going to go absolutely crazy or, you know, he's going to turn out to be like some sort of sublime hero.
We'll
played
himself,
by a very
basically.
Young Vincent D'Onofrio.
Indeed. But I mean, this has to be fairly, I don't know, I'm sure this is all fairly common in like the military or anywhere where you have this kind of like enforced discipline. It always struck me as it must all be quite horrific in ways that we never quite hear about. So.
Yeah, and you kind of learn about like the recruit's life. It's like morning is training and then they're sent out to do various tasks to see what they're good at.
John did show he took Tyrion's advice, though, in owning the fact that he's a bastard. He even introduced himself as Ned Stark's bastard.
Yeah.
True. And also, he says, he references Tyrion again when he's like, it takes a certain kind of like courage to admit you're a coward. Like, he owns it.
Mm. Yeah, and he also took the advice from Donald Noy in helping the others to, you know, get better at swordsmanship and improve their skills.
Right, not to be a bully.
Yep.
For a guy who's so good at taking advice and being all perceptive, it's amazing what a hash he makes of being Lord Commander. Well, I might be being a little bit unfair there, but yeah.
Maybe a little bit, but you're not totally off.
I'm looking forward to that if we ever make it through to, like, you know, episode 63 of this podcast reread, to reassessing my view of John because I was not kind to him the first time I read Feast Dance, so, yeah. Mm. We'll see.
Well, if we ever get wins, that'll be nice too.
John is dead.
We could only be so lucky.
Yeah, exactly.
He's going through those crypts and he doesn't see himself there.
I think even the kind of the idiot TV viewers have figured out that John's not actually dead, so
yeah.
Sucks.
Idiot TV viewers, you might be alienating some people.
I don't think idiot TV viewers who don't read the books are gonna be listening to this podcast.
Hey, I'm an idiot TV viewer as well. Come on.
No,
yeah,
but
you're
I,
making the podcast. You're not listening to the podcast.
No, idiot TV viewers are people who don't read the books at all.
Well, I'm also an idiot podcaster, so.
Oh. Well, then you're where you belong. You know?
Exactly.
Okay, I apologize to any idiot TV viewers who may be listening. Nadia, is it possible?
Just call him right cunts and it'll sound endearing.
When was that ever endearing?
I don't know. Anytime any English person calls someone a cunt, it sounds endearing.
English people don't go around calling each other cunts.
Are you sure?
I just want you to know that.
So it's not like a formal greeting over there?
Yeah, we don't slap each other on the back and go, you know, how's it going, you old cunt? No, that's not.
I think that's our lead in right there.
Cool, blimey, governor, strike a light. No, that's not. It's not something like Dick Van Dyke meets the Wire view of England. No. Okay. On to Cat 5, which skips over Ned 6. Cat and Sir Roderick head to the inn at the crossroads. She's so rain-sodden that when Sir John Malister and his knights ride past, they don't recognize her. At the inn, Cat decides not to go west to River Run as her father is bedridden, which always struck me as a bit weird because why would she not tell whoever's in charge and warn them just because her father's ill? Anyway, we can discuss that later. She also decides not to go east because it's really dangerous crossing the mountains to the Eyrie, and even Jon Arryn would only do so with a massive guard, although that's a shame because at least Lysa would have some info on how her husband died. So Cat decides to head back north and wonders just how loyal her bannermen are, particularly the late Lord Frey. So we get the story about how he only sort of joined the war late in the day because he was waiting to see which side would win. So then Cat and Sir Roderick go down to the common room, and Cat and Roderick meet the cocky singer Marillion. And Tyrion and his men come into the inn And Marillion's sort of trying to catch their attention, and in doing so directs Tyrion's gaze to Kat, and he actually recognizes her immediately. So Kat at that point, presumably spontaneously, decides to call upon the people in the room who are loyal to House Tully and House Stark, and those of House Went and Bracken respond, and she has Tyrion arrested in the name of King Robert. So arguably starts the war right there. But we can discuss that as we get into it. And we also, it's worth pointing out, in retrospect, we now know that Bronn was also at the inn. So I have questions, many questions that need answers. First of all, after King's Landing, why doesn't Kat just sail back to Winterfell the way she came there?
Because it's one of many bad life decisions.
Sorry, Nadia, did you want to go first?
Wouldn't that have been a lot quicker, going by sea?
And safer?
Yeah. Maybe she just wouldn't want to put Sir Roderick through all that again.
Yeah, I think it's pretty weak.
Perhaps.
Or it's just a plot point, you know, just to get Kat at the inn at the crossroads.
Maybe it's just another one of her bad life decisions that she makes along the way.
Counterfactual history. If Kat had sailed back to Winterfell, would anything have
happened? No, this would have fucking happened!
No, but really? I mean, would she...
There would be no fucking story! It's okay, amazing okay, so how much she fucks everything up. Oh, sorry, I was mixing myself a drink, so I couldn't...
Let's just do this what-if situation, okay? Let's just have that discussion. What if Kat went straight back to Winterfell and actually got there? What would have been different?
Go on, Nadi, tell us what would have happened.
Okay, so on her way back, she meets Rob, right? In the Riverlands already. So that means Rob would have left before she got there anyway.
No, Rob left in response to her napping Ned's at Tyrion. And then, Ned's imprisonment and then the rallying of troops.
So she gets back to Winterfell. Rob's still there.
So,
Everything is fucking peaceful. There's no more, like...
So she's there. So is Rob. And so is Rob. But then... Does that mean Ned doesn't get arrested at all?
Well, it means...
Yeah, because Jaime goes after Ned and stabs him in the leg because Tyrion's been snaffled. Is that how it goes?
Yes!
Yep.
Matt's just losing it.
So Ned doesn't get injured, okay? So Ned doesn't hurt his leg. He still has some of his men left. All of his men, whatever men he had, 100 men maybe. Okay? So he has all those remaining to him.
He probably would still have had civil war because Stannis is still in Dragonstone.
But Robert still dies, right? Cersei still goes through her plan.
Yeah.
No, she doesn't. I don't think she does.
Why not?
She has to accelerate her plan.
Why? Why is Cersei's plan affected by all this shit?
Because now her father's, like, raiding the Riverlands, like, butchering, like, peasants, and then Ned would have gone out, like,
Dad's not raiding the Riverland. We're not yet at that part, are we?
Yeah, also, Robb Stark would have marshaled the men per Ned's orders, unless, you know, Kat just suddenly forgot him along the way home. And then he would have been a good spot to just sit back and defend the entire North without getting invaded.
The only point at which Cersei still carries out her plan is if she still believes Renly and Loras are trying to have her replaced. So maybe eventually she does poison Robert, and at that point, Ned is still hand of the king. And then I think the flaw in the plan is that Stannis is still in Dragonstone, so it depends on whether Stannis decides to cause shit, and then Renly decides to cause shit. But it's very much a kind of a war of inheritance that's within the Baratheon Lannister clan, and the Starks, if they wanted to, could decide to back all or no one, or just, you know, do whatever they wanted to do, right?
Well, I think it all kind of hinges on if she goes back to Winterfell by boat. It all hinges on whether or not Robert gets killed. If he doesn't get killed, then Renly's plan can move forward, same as Stannis's, with the exposing of, you know, the incest. And then, yeah, the realm probably drops into some sort of civil war. Because it's not like the Lannisters are going to be like, oh, okay, you got us. You know, Tywin's going to point out every single flaw about Robert, how, you know, he's sleeping around with all these women, how he's, you know, thrown the realm into a serious amount of debt, and probably come up with a lot of excuses like how Robert's just trying to get out of paying back, you know, the Lannisters for all the money they owe him. And they're not going to want to give up on that. They just, you know, spent all that time getting, you know, a Lannister as queen. So there's no way they're going to let go of that.
So do you think that in the event of a sort of a war of inheritance, who would the Starks have supported? I mean, does he stay loyal to Robert, even though his like serial philandering is exposed? And then if you stay loyal to Robert, does that mean you back Stannis because he's the rightful heir?
Yeah, I think knowing Ned, he would probably be backing Stannis, considering that that's what he actually does when Robert dies, right? He intended to put all his weight behind Stannis, right?
Yeah.
Which is why he didn't go with Renly's plan.
I think Ned would back Robert if Robert lived, because Robert was still king. You know, if Robert dies, yeah, then he's going to back Stannis.
I mean, he's childless, he's 36, he's only, what, 36 or 37, but he's, like, actually really old because he's fat and, you know, drinks all the time.
Yeah, but he's not childless.
He's
going to
die anyway. Well, he's not childless, but these are all illegitimate children, unless he legitimizes Edric Storm.
Which he could do.
Or he could
do. But is there any precedent for a legitimized son to become a king? There isn't.
There is in England. I mean, look, but I'm not sure that during the counts. Fire.
That's why
the whole Blackfyre thing happened because
yeah, exactly. The whole Blackfyre thing tore the realm apart anyway. So you know, there's.
Well, I think that's why Renly's plan makes so much more sense, because if a Tyrell marries Robert, then that's sort of bringing them in on their side, and then you're looking at, you know, an alliance of the Starks, the Tullys, the Baratheons, the Tyrells. The Greyjoys will probably get forced in to providing, you know, naval support because of Theon being a hostage. And that just basically leaves the Lannisters all on their own. I mean, there's absolutely nobody that's going to help them at that point. They have no allies. There's certainly Dorne's not going to help them. Okay, Dorne wants them
right.
dead.
And
they're going
to
have to...
Here's the thing. How do you set aside Joffrey, Myrcella, and Tommen aside? I mean, you don't exactly have DNA tests, right? You don't have conclusive proof that Cersei and Jaime have been committing incest all this time. I mean, yes, there is, you know...
There's Bran.
There's Bran, but he doesn't exactly remember, right?
Well, that's the whole point that I think John Aaron was trying to make.
So you haven't had, like, a black-haired child for generations, but that doesn't mean it can't happen.
It doesn't mean it can't happen, but that was John Aaron's point. It's really, really, really unlikely to happen. And it's sort of like if you build enough circumstantial evidence, you can kind of convince some people of some things. And I think that's what they were really going for. They didn't.
But would you be able to convince Robert of that?
Does Robin even give a fuck at this point? He's so uninterested.
Exactly, he doesn't, right? He doesn't, so he wouldn't be moved to set aside Joffrey, Myrcella, and Tommen anyway.
He might be, because he doesn't like Cersei.
Right.
You know,
he likes Cersei, but he likes conflict even less.
He wants whatever enables him to have a peaceful life where he can drink and whore.
No. He loved, like, being at battle and going to war. Like, one of the things...
Right, even Ned coming
he
out,
loves
like...
But
war?
Now, like, even now in the shape
he
he's currently
war,
in...
But not, like, conflict in his own home, right?
He still wanted to enter the melee. Like, he still wants to fight. Like, even Ned says, like, there's nothing, like, Robert would like more than to, like, fight a, like, Lannister host or someone that, like, was opposing him in some way.
So then the question is,
started this whole thing. Like, there was tension before, and she just fucking opened up the dam. Like, oh my god. So, like, how
can I ask you
fucking...
a question, though, Matt? If Marillion hadn't been like, hey, over here, when Catelyn saw Tyrion walk in, would she have arrested him, or did she only do it because he noticed her? Like, do you think she was always going to arrest him? Because that's kind of slightly worse. But if she did it spontaneously because he noticed her, I think that's kind of, like, more forgivable because, you know, you have a split second to decide what you're going to do, so...
And she chose poorly.
Because you never made any questionable decisions in your life.
Okay, so this is one question that I've had for a long time.
I've almost always made questionable decisions. But no, she takes him hostage because of the lies that Lysa told about the Lannisters killing them, Jon Arryn, even though she killed Jon Arryn. Like, this whole thing, like, Forget.
Well, no, I see where you're going with this. Catelyn tends to think emotionally. You know, that's how she reasons out things. You know, she's not going to let a little thing like, you know, the facts or the truth stand in her way.
Women, am I right?
You said it, not me.
That's the episode opening. So it's okay for me to, like, piss off, like, TV viewers who are not going to listen to this podcast, but you can insult the entirety of womankind?
I don't see a problem there. What?
Oh, legend.
No, it was a complete joke. Come on.
Yeah, no, don't worry, I'm not offended. Sorry, Scott, please continue.
Okay, something that has confused me for a long time. Why would Catelyn not have arrested Tyrion if he hadn't recognized her? I mean, okay, so he recognized her, but wouldn't she have wanted to arrest him anyway? Because, you know, all of the lies have already been told by Lysa and the evidence that, you know, Baelish supposedly gave Catelyn, that, you know, the dagger was Tyrion's and everything. Wouldn't Catelyn have arrested him anyway, even if he hadn't recognized her? Why was that the thing that sort of moved her?
Well, that's what I'm asking. Would she have arrested him? Or would she have just waited till she got home to Winterfell and then act in position?
She already had all the evidence anyway, right? Why didn't she arrest him before? Why didn't she just sort of surprise him and arrest him anyway?
Like, where was she going to arrest him? This is basically her best chance. Tyrion's showing up with, like, three guys, and then she sees, like, maybe 30 or 40 guys that would, you know, side with her and help her out. This is a big opportunity, and Tyrion kind of puts her on the spot. And
yeah, but that's that's what I'm saying. She sees Tyrion before he sees her, right? Why didn't she make the first move?
Yeah, good point. I'm not so sure she was going to arrest him anyway. And I think it's more forgivable if it's a spontaneous decision. That's all I'm saying. Sorry, Vali. We can agree to disagree.
As per usual. But she should have brought him to King's Landing and not to the Eyrie.
Well, at this point, I think she thinks King's Landing's sort of enemy territory, right? I mean, she's already been told it's so unsafe she has to stay in a brothel and see her husband, so... I have another question, though. You know, like, Tyrion's like, well, why on earth would you believe Littlefinger? Because he's the guy who's, like, saying that he slept with you all over town. But doesn't Littlefinger actually believe he did take Kat's virginity? Because he was, when he slept with Lysa, he genuinely thought it was Kat. So my question is, has Littlefinger since realized that he didn't do that? Or does he still delusionally think when he's bragging, does he genuinely think he did it?
I think maybe in some small part of his brain he thinks that he knows that he didn't do it, but he just, you know, he wants to believe it so much that he just doesn't care.
Classic stalker.
I think it's revenge for all the mud pies they served him as a kid.
So you think he knows it's a lie?
No. Of course he does.
No, he doesn't. He was very young and he was very drunk. He doesn't know it wasn't Kat.
Vali is a man who was often very young and very drunk. What do you think?
Hard pass.
Oh, hilarious. Okay. Any more in this chapter? Oh, yeah, like, we should talk about, or maybe that comes into the next chapter. Who does and doesn't stand up and, like, you know, front up to this. Not that I'm, like, being bad on the TV show and stuff, but the TV show episode does make it look like everyone in the inn just stands up and, you know, is with Kat.
Mm.
Which evidently wasn't the case. But I think that's the next chapter. Marillion, thoughts? He's a new character.
Fuck him.
Yeah.
Has anyone read Amin's essay on songs in Song of Ice and Fire? Because I haven't.
I think I have.
Does it say anything about Marillion?
Just that minstrels in general are kind of like the poor people's like historians. And I thought that was pretty insightful because, you know, like there are certain stories that are told in history that are relayed by singers and not like by people that can actually read books. So it was pretty good.
Yeah, I should totally, you know, read that. Okay, on to Tyrion 4. So to get to Tyrion 4, we skip over Sansa 2 and Ned 7 because we're basically skipping over the Tourney of the Hand chapters, which will be done on the next episode. So over to Nadia.
Okay. Okay, so Tyrion 4, over the mountains to the Eyrie. Tyrion wisely notes that not many people responded to Kat's order to have him arrested, including the Freys, and that Yoren didn't get involved as the Night's Watch stays neutral. She seems to rely on the eternal gratitude of House Stark versus the hard currency of Lannister gold. He's confident someone will go for the gold and tell his family he's being taken to Winterfell, until he realizes that Kat conned him and he's actually going east. Tyrion protests his innocence and tells Kat Littlefinger isn't to be trusted. After all, he tells everyone he deflowered Kat. Moreover, Tyrion would never have bet against his own family and therefore wouldn't have won the knife. They are attacked by mountain clans and Tyrion saves Kat's life. Also, Kat slits a guy's throat. Did she always have that stone heart darkness in her? That's been a question of mine.
I totally forgot that she did this. And when I read that, I was like, oh, Lady Stoneheart. Like, just the idea that, you know, not because she herself has her throat slit, but just that there is a certain ruthless cruelty in Kat. She's just not a simpering lady of the house. And
Is this really? Darkness? I thought it was just self-defense.
Yeah, I think it's self-defense. I agree with Nadia.
Self-defense? But, yeah, you know, slitting a guy's throat? I mean, I don't know.
Well, she does it later to the Freeze family jester, so...
Yeah, but that makes it even worse, right? I mean...
Jester's way worse, because it's not like the jester was any threat.
Right, but she was, like, physically under attack, I think, you know.
Yeah, it was, like, 3-on-1 when Tyrion came to save her.
Yeah, and I think Tyrion only did that because they were legitimately all under attack.
Yeah, which actually kind of, you know, redeems Tyrion. I mean, if his plot was really to start... You know, seeing members of House Stark dead, there's a perfect opportunity to just do nothing. And what happened to Catelyn? Well, turns out, you know, she wasn't tough enough to take on three mountain people.
At this point, Tyrion is, you know, a relatively decent guy, right? So
yeah, more or less.
I think that was the only main part in this chapter, right? Other than Tyrion's own thoughts.
Yeah, but I mean, I think for me, it was all about how Tyrion's, like, really perceptive that, you know, he's really analysed the dynamics in the inn at the crossroads. He's taken note of who did and didn't stand up. He's figured out that the phrase of the weak link, which I guess foreshadows to the Red Wedding. It's just, yeah, you just get more and more admiration for Tyrion, I think, is the main thing. But also, like, you know, Kat, although you were saying earlier, okay, she acts out of emotion.
George, I mean,
she's not.
George is already planting that Frey thing in, like, the very beginning of the first book.
Yeah, which is amazing, right? But also that Kat, okay, she acts emotionally, but she's not stupid, so the whole kind of telling everyone she's going to Riverrun and then he takes off his blindfold at the end of the first day and realizes that she's had the better of him in that respect, I think is quite kind of, you know, Kat's a really complex character. I'm sort of getting more respect for her on this reread, I guess.
Really?
Yeah, I had zero though, so it's from a low base.
Oh, okay.
So Eddie, yeah. I don't know, she seems to balance out the smart things that she does with something incredibly stupid. Like, right after the fight, she's like, okay guys, we should probably dig some graves and, you know, bury our dead. And Bronn is just like, no, we need to get the hell out of here. This is a terrible idea. You know, we need to move.
Yeah, you also see the... kind of budding relationship of Bronn and Tyrion in this chapter too.
Do we know if Bronn was at the end of the crossroads for a specific purpose? Was he on somebody's payroll, or was he just happened to be one of the, you know, number of people passing through to the tourney of the hand? Do we ever find that out?
I think he was just passing through. I mean, he's a sellsword, so he's probably just looking to, like, get into some lord's, you know, retinue.
Yeah, but he's also really smart, too. So that kind of makes me think that, you know, if somebody wanted to hire him like Littlefinger or Varys, then he would, you know, not be a half-bad guy to have in your pocket.
Yeah, I agree.
But where would they come in contact with a sellsword, like Bronn, until he reaches King's Landing?
Well, Varys has a whole spy network, so, I mean, it wouldn't be too difficult to, you know, reach out and just find people who are, you know, good quality. And if you find someone who's decent, to keep reusing those same people and keep buying their loyalty. So that doesn't seem like it would be out of the realm of possibility.
But does Varys' spy network extend that far? To me, it seems that it mostly, you know, centers in King's Landing and just...
Well, he knew what Kat was doing, you know, why she was traveling to King's Landing before she got there. So yeah, it does. It at least goes up to White Harbor in the north where she caught the boat.
And also into Esso, so, like, his spy network is really vast.
Mm. He's like the old school version of the NSA.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, on to Ned Six. So, Janus Slint reports that the City Watch is being overwhelmed with all the peeps coming into King's Landing for the tourney, and Ned increases their numbers with some of his own troops. He's still, like, totally unimpressed with the whole idea of the tourney as a waste of money. But Littlefinger's all like, yeah, but I'm making lots of money in my brothel business. Which then prompts Renly to tell them all how Stannis banned brothels and how he's totally amazed that the guy managed to father a child. And he's also in a slightly douchey kind of point, like really, like he calls Shireen his ugly daughter because she's obviously been disfigured with Grayscale, which is just mean. And then we have a moment with Jory and Ned, where he tells him that they've been interviewing the people that Littlefinger identified from Jon Arryn's household. And he discovers that Jon and Stannis were apparently visiting brothels together, which is weird because A, they weren't friends, and B, we know Stannis doesn't like brothels. So this prompts Ned to be all suspicious about why is Stannis hiding out in Dragonstone when, you know, this is a very sort of senior and powerful guy. Why would he need to flee, and why would he go to the one place where he has such bad memories? And also, he's suspicious of Renly because he's touting this picture of Margaery Tyrell and asking if she looks like Lyanna, so he's obviously up to no good. And I guess we will later find out that Renly's plotting to have Robert marry Margaery and is hoping that he reminds him of Lyanna. And then finally, Ned retraces Jon's steps to the forge where he finds Gendry working and, you know, realizes very clearly that this is Robert's bastard and that's what Jon was onto and the fact that he has this black hair. And he also discovers, or rather the head of the forge kind of lets slip that someone paid his apprenticeship fee. And then you get this description of the guy who paid the fee, which kind of stupidly, I'd always assumed it was Robert. I think maybe just because the guy had a beard, but I now see that this was nonsense. I've written any other theories. So I have questions. Who did pay the fee? Why is Stannis on Dragonstone not holding his ground? And is he just waiting for Robert to sort of randomly die? Or, you know, what Stannis is thinking on Dragonstone, I guess. Over to you guys.
Gendry's here. Yay.
It's really funny to me in retrospect because so many people were losing hormones over Gendry in the TV show. And every other thing he's been on since on British TV or film, he's looked so ugly because he's either been ginger or blonde or whatever. So clearly the hair had a lot to do with it. That's a very superficial comment, sorry. The guys are totally nonplussed by this.
Alright, so the question was like, I'm sorry, I was letting you swoon over Gendry.
The
question was,
staying well out of it. Why is Stannis on Dragonstone? That's my basic question.
I'd say basically because people started killing members of the council, and Stannis kind of realized it. He got out ahead of it.
You think he was just spooked by Jon getting poisoned. Okay.
Yeah, he figured Cersei was making a move because they realized they were looking into the incest possibility, and he was just like, oh shit, time to split town. I'm out.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think once Jon Arryn, like, they both kind of figured it out, and once Jon Arryn was poisoned, he was like, oh, I'm probably next. Like, gotta go.
Yeah, it seems like someone on the council was, you know, speaking to all the other members of the council at some point and just sort of being like, oh, by the way, isn't it kind of strange how Robert only has blonde children, you know, with Cersei, but everybody else he has children with has dark hair. So, I mean, somebody must have sort of tipped him off, probably another council member.
And the council member we're predicting is Littlefinger?
Probably Littlefinger.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, that would just remove, like, a power player from the council, right?
Well, it would play into a scheme to kill Jon Arryn and start a war, so, yeah, that would make a lot of sense. It's obviously not Pycelle, because Pycelle's loyal to the Lannisters, so he would actually kill to protect, you know, the current situation, not the other way around.
I wonder who Stannis thinks Varys is loyal to. Do you all think Stannis is clever?
Not really.
But he's not dumb either, is he? I mean, he's...
No, he's certainly not dumb, but I think he's clever in, like,
military tactics and, like...
I wouldn't say clever. He's...
He's brilliant when it comes to military strategy.
Is he?
Yeah, he held out on Storm's End. And then he also...
But that was just holding out. That didn't require any particular strategy. But he's...
But he also crushed Balon Greyjoy's fleet.
Victarion's fleet, yeah. But again, he lost at Blackwater, right? Pretty badly.
Yeah, but that's only because Tywin showed up with the Tyrells. So, I mean, that was something that he couldn't have predicted. So it's sort of a situation where if he has the full scope of the land and he can kind of weigh everything out, he does really well in those sort of battles. But when things, you know, change that are completely unpredictable, then, yeah, that's going to happen to him because, whoops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Steve Atwell and Brendan's blog, Brendan Blackfish's blog, like, really goes into detail about, like, how he is a good military commander, but I think he has more, he's almost like Ned, where it's like more tactics rather than being politic.
I was just going to say something similar, but I was going to say that Stannis seems actually smarter than Ned.
I think they're both great twos. They're both great executing out orders, getting shit done. I think they're both good military commanders.
Stannis has the presence of mind to leave King's Landing immediately.
But he was also thick in like the intrigue and everything that was going on in King's Landing, whereas Ned is like fish out of water. Like, you know, he doesn't know all the backstory. Like, you know, he's been ruling the North, and now he's like put into this like, you know, this like political system that he's a newbie. Like, he doesn't know everyone's backstory. Like, all he knows is like the Lannisters are ambitious, Robert's a drunk, and, you know, Renly's doing whatever he's doing, and Stannis is doing whatever he's doing, and Littlefinger, who the fuck knows what he's doing, you know. Hello?
Yeah, no, I'm here. I'm just pondering actually. Stannis is, he's a tricky character, and I don't know, I'm probably being influenced by TV show Stannis. And he changes so much, he evolves so much, like, by the time we get to Dance, and I have, like, so much more respect for him. And yet, I don't know.
He seems like, when you meet him in, like, a Clash of Kings, he seems just like a straight prick. Like, he's no good. But then, like, you really get to know him over the rest of the books, and he's okay.
I don't know. To me, he's always been sort of the polar opposite of Renly. You know, Stannis is really good when it comes to military matters. He's, you know, a really clear-cut black and white kind of guy, but people just can't stand him for his personality. And Renly's just the absolute opposite. You know, he's
Davos.
What's that?
Stannis has Davos on his side. That says a lot.
Davos is, pretty much redeemed Stannis.
Why is Davos so loyal to Stannis? Let's discuss that now.
Well, can we discuss it when we're doing Clash of Kings?
Sure, in 2018 we can get around to that.
Yeah. You won't wait that long.
But it is true, and I don't know. I think at this point in the books, Stannis is a very shadowy character. We've only heard of him, we don't know much about him. People are basically bad-mouthing him, so it's hard to make a judgment.
It's kind of the same treatment that Tywin gets, too, because at this point you haven't met Tywin either, and you know, all you're hearing is, you know, about how his ambitions have manifested and, you know, some of the other background things about him, but you never actually, you know, see sort of an on-screen appearance from him.
I agree. Aww.
It's amazing, really, because we're halfway through the first book and, like, two of the people who are major, major characters we've not yet met. So...
Mm.
Yeah, it's the twins' first appearance on the podcast. Anything else on this chapter? Would the twins like to comment? I think they're voicing their displeasure at Stannis. That's how I interpret it anyway. Nope.
No, I got nothing.
Yeah, that's about it.
Cool. Well, we breezed through that. It's amazing how when White Raven isn't distracting us with B-Day kind of chat, how quickly we can get through this. Okay. Well, if no one has anything else, thank you all for joining. I'll try and edit this.
An hour and 12 minutes?
I know. It's like a record. Okay.
Well, no crackpot theory.
Yeah, so do you? So Scott, you're new to the podcast. I feel you should sign us out with a crackpot theory.
Okay.
Wow, you went for, I wish everyone else went for stuff when I said it that quickly. That's amazing.
Yeah, seriously. What do you got up your sleeve?
It's R plus P equals D. Riverlanders plus pies equals death.
Do you want to elaborate
on
that?
Go on.
Well, I kind of thought this when I was reading the cat chapter, where Littlefinger and gets fed all the mud pies by Cat and Lysa, and then, you know, he ends up being sick for a week, and that's basically what that moment in time is, what sort of changed him from being sort of this little love-struck youth into the cunning and master manipulator and evil character that we know he turns into. So, and look how many people died from his actions in starting the War of the Five Kings. And like later on down the road, Lord Manderly serves pies made out of Riverlanders at Fake Arya's wedding in Winterfell. And that's just a bloodbath waiting to happen. So more Riverlanders, more pies, soon to be death.
I like it.
That is genius.
I'm on board.
I'm on board. Yeah. That's not even crackpot. That's just a theory. That's just fact. It is known.
Well, actually, it's even worse. Arya actually starts worshipping death, like when she starts hanging out with Hot Pie. So, just like dragons are made flesh, Hot Pie is confectionary doom. He ends up in the Riverlands.
Hot Pie is confectionary doom.
He is.
I love this so much.
He's in the Riverlands, and the Riverlands hasn't known peace throughout the war. In fact, the Riverlands have been like the most war-torn part of the Seven Kingdoms.
Does this mean all the Riverlanders have to do is get rid of Hot Pie?
Well, it certainly wouldn't hurt. actually, where does he end up? He's actually at
somebody the, should tell them that.
No, he's actually at the Inn of the Kneeling Man. That's where he ends up staying. Which everybody eventually kneels before death. So yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. That's probably why Varys was sending him to the Wall.
I got nothing, man.
It's dropped. Solid. That's it. Your work is done. That was legend. Where is Hot? So Hot Pie right now is just living a life of peace somewhere, right? Still in the Riverlands?
Yeah, he's at the Inn of the Kneeling Man, like just working as a cook.
Do you think we're going to see him again in the books?
Oh, hopefully.
Probably.
Yeah, because
when he and Arya are traveling through the Riverlands, like they're surrounded by nothing but death and destruction every single chapter.
So basically, it's not all Kat's fault. It's actually Hot Pie's fault.
And Scott is coming in on his first podcast hot.
I know. Well, he came in on the podcast Device and Fire Forums hot, right? Like, he joined in the house micro and were, like, just dropping knowledge left, right, and center. So, you know, raise the bar.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, man. Making us all look bad.
No, it's good, because on every VOC, you need to have someone who actually knows some shit. So I feel that Scott's filling the role previously held by Kay Centurion and actually, like, knowing stuff.
Yeah, we are not that person.
No. If I was that person, I wouldn't be doing the reread, right? So that's my excuse.
Yeah, but you sound good when you do the reread.
Aww.
It's the accent. Don't let it fool you.
This is why I haven't been to Brighton yet, Vali.
Eventually.
Eventually I'll make it, but not until the summer, because it's just cold.
No, come in the fall. Freezing. Come in the fall. That's the best time to visit New England.
What is this fall you speak of?
Autumn?
When all the
autumn.
All the leaves turn pretty colors, and it's manageably, like, you know, nice to wear a coat and not sweat, but not be completely freezing either.
That's a gorgeous visual image. Okay, well, if that's all we have to say, thanks to everybody for listening, and I would like to thank Matt, Scott, and Nadia for joining. If you
welcome.
Would...
Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you.
And if you would like to play it along at home, the next episode will be The Tourney of the Hand, so All Manner of Shit Goes Down. We'll be covering Sansa 2, Ned 7, Arya 3, Ned 8, and Ned 9. So for Ned lovers, it's the chapter, if there are any out there, that's the chapter for you. Otherwise, if you want to sign up or do any other stuff, we're on the A Podcast Device and Fire forums. You can find us at VOK Podcast on Twitter and at vokpodcast.wordpress.com. So thanks for listening.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. I've been an awfully good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa baby, a 54 convertible too.
Is Amber lurking?
Amber was lurking. You just missed her, actually. In fact, I think you might be the same person because I've never seen you in the same room together.
It's the greatest trick we ever pulled.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's true. The minute she left, you showed up.
Like, literally the minute.
Yeah.
Oh, were those the twins?
Cute.
What an adorable creature.
Yeah, she really wants to talk right
now. Go on, Matt, talk to the baby. You're a godfather now. What's her name?
I will be a godfather. I'm very excited.
What, you were asking her name, Nina?
Yeah.
Oh, this is Naya.
Hey, Naya. Oh, she's talking. So cute. One day, like, when we finish this linear reread and all the kids who've, like, gurgled on this podcast, like 10 and 11, they can just take it over. It'd be great.
Are you kidding me? They're going to be legally able to drink by the time we finish this.
Yeah, and the next book will be up by then, too.
Yeah, hopefully.
Don't tease like that. That's just mean.
Well, it's only 21 years away.
No, the book is coming out in 2016. I really want the book.
Really wanting and making it actually happen are two different things, Nadia. But I'm also convinced the book...
No, but it's coming out 2016, and I will believe it until December 31st, 2016.
I think it's coming out before the next show, actually, before the next season.
I think that's what he said school was.
Yeah, well, he says a lot of things.
When do you think it's out, Scott?
When do I think it starts?
It's out, like the next
What's
book.
What's out? I don't know, probably March?
Oh, so you agree with me, then?
Sure.
Oh, sweet summer children. Come on.